slept. They scarcely wept before they laughed. They drank indeed death's bitter draught, but all its bitterest dregs were kept and drained by mothers while they wept. So wrote poet Christina Rossetti of the slaughter of the innocents in Matthew. How do you forgive the unforgivable? I chose the question, the hardest question of all the questions you asked, for Epiphany, for the first Sunday of the supposedly new year, the Sunday when we mark the coming of God's light into our darkness. You asked the question last spring, little knowing how innocence that scarcely waked before they slept, that scarcely wept before they laughed, would drink indeed death's bitter draught in Newtown. And I chose this question, little comprehending how its bitterest dregs would be kept and drained by mothers and fathers as they wept, and as still we weep with them. Luke's narrative is not dark enough to contain the world we must do our forgiving in. Only Matthew's will do. How do you forgive the unforgivable? We ask this of ourselves in the context of our most intimate relationships, of those who know us best and so can hurt us most. We ask this of ourselves in the context of our common life, of the deranged, as we call them, who wield death in schools and malls and movie theaters, the loner empowered by an automatic weapon to settle accounts with the society whose rejection could be tolerated no longer. We ask this of ourselves in the context of a century already bathed in the blood of terrorists' attacks and counterattacks, the innocents felled alongside the guilty day after bloody day. And we ask this of ourselves in the context of our faith, whose crown is the doctrine of the forgiveness of sins. How do you forgive the unforgivable? The 20th century Christian ethicist Reinhold Niebuhr insists that the how of forgiving has something to do with our asking our question of ourselves, our unforgivable selves. In a chapter entitled Love as Forgiveness, he acknowledges that forgiveness is the most difficult and impossible of moral achievements. Yet he writes, it is a possibility if the impossibility of love is recognized and the sin of the self is acknowledged. Let me say that again. Love as forgiveness is possible if the impossibility of love is recognized and the sin of the self is acknowledged. Taking the second first, according to Niebuhr, the implicit assumption of your question, that you are, that I am, the one doing the forgiving of the other who is unforgivable, is fundamentally flawed. Forgiveness, by definition, reverses the subject and the object of the sentence, demanding that the evil of the other shall be borne without vindictiveness. Why? Because the evil of the self is known. themselves most in need of mercy. Let me quickly add, I know there is no fairness in this fact. You have been wronged, deeply wronged by another's meanness or moral failure or malevolence, or in the case of heinous and inhuman acts, another's evil. You are perfectly free and within your rights not to act mercifully. Psychologists would even counsel that your mercy may only enable the offender to continue offending. Trust has been lost. Vulnerability dictates self-care. The depth of evil must be reckoned with. Reason and research confirm these observations to be the case. Now, it is only if you mean to forgive the unforgivable that you must begin with yourself. Back to Niebuhr. Forgiving love is a possibility only for those who know that they are not good, who feel themselves in need of divine mercy, who live in a dimension deeper and higher than that of moral idealism, feel themselves as well as their fellows convicted of sin by a holy God, and know that the difference between the good person and the bad person are insignificant in his sight. Of course, we seldom see ourselves this way, do we? We take instead the side of the angels, whether angels to the right or angels to the left, making us more secure in our self-respect and therefore ruthless against our foes. The consequence, says Niebuhr, is that we fight for our causes around the kitchen table or in the halls of Congress or across the ocean, with a fury of which only those are capable who are secure in the sense of their own righteousness. Face to face with another's moral failures, it is very difficult to see our own, and therefore impossible to forgive what our better goodness judges to be unforgivable. Perhaps this blindness is why Peter Bruegel set his painting of the massacres of the innocents in a village that looked for all the world like every village in the Netherlands during the 1560s. In Bruegel's Snowscape, writes art critic Jonathan Jones, a village is being turned upside down by soldiers who have come on behalf of Philip II, not Herod, Philip II, King of Spain, to do what? To punish heresy. To show what happens when provinces revolt against God. The armored horsemen are a tight, compressed mass, black against the white snow. They wait in patient menace while foot soldiers with pikes and battering rams bash the doors of houses and drag villagers into the main square. Without going into great detail, suffice it to say that the characters in the painting who claim divine sanction are the soldiers, ruthlessly defending God's truth against Calvinist heresy. Picture's realism later caused an unknown hand to paint There would be no lone killer on the campus with haunting eyes holding a Bushmaster 223. Nor would the representative spokesperson for the NRA be portrayed as, say, Herod overseeing the massacre, as I did the Sunday before Christmas. Rather, the painting would be set in the city of brotherly love, perhaps, with the streets clogged by a multitude representing an entire nation armed. Each of us could paint in our own faces, armed and marching toward a schoolhouse in defense of the God to whom we offer our children as sacrifices. Paint their faces into all your palette. Here the words of another poet are prescient. John Milton writes of the sacrifice of children to the fires of the God Molech, mentioned in Leviticus. He writes, "First Moloch, the horrid king, besmeared with blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears, though for the noise of drums and timbrels loud, their children's cries unheard, that passed through fire to his grim idol." Citing Milton, Gary Wills blogged on December 15th that the horror of the slaughter of the innocents this Advent cannot be blamed on one unhinged person. It was the sacrifice we as a culture made and continually make to our demonic God. We guarantee that crazed man after crazed man will have a flood of killing power readily supplied to him. We have to make that offering out of devotion to our Moloch, our God. The gun is our Moloch. We sacrifice children to him daily. Well, goes on to say that the gun is not a mere tool, a bit of technology, a political issue, a point of debate. It is an object of reverence. An object of reverence. Devotion to it precludes interruption of sacrifices it entails. Like most gods, it does what it will and cannot be questioned. Adoration of Moloch permeates the country, he concludes, imposing a hushed silence as he works his will. One cannot question his rights, even as blood is gushing through the idol's teeth. Whether at the end of a barrel of a gun, or with a little hand on a mouse that makes our children virtual killers before they even enter kindergarten, we have sacrificed our children to a God whose victims, to a God whose violence and murderous ways have been sanctioned by our silence, if not also our outright obeisance. This strikes me as unforgivable. To acknowledge the heinous sin of child sacrifice, that is mine, mine. I know only enough to beseech God for the mercy I do not deserve. Mercy, I read on Christmas Day, is the willingness to enter the chaos of the other. Even more than Luke, Matthew is telling us that God in Christ has had mercy upon us, has willingly entered our murderous chaos to dwell. not fair, nor is it necessary that God show us such mercy, unless God be love. Forgiveness is possible, says Niebuhr, in the second place. If the impossibility of love is recognized, not in you, not in me, but in this vulnerable baby boy, how will you ask again? I repeat, as mercy enters the chaos of another. Entitled simply Forgiven, an article in today's New York Times Magazine tells of the murder of 19-year-old Anne Grossmayer by her 19-year-old boyfriend named Connor McBride, who, when she was on her knees begging for her life, shot her in the face. As Anne lay dying in the hospital, her face covered with bandages, intubated and unconscious, her father, Andy, felt her say to him, "Forgive him." His response was immediate. "No," he said out loud. "No way. It's impossible. You're asking too much." But Andy kept hearing his daughter's voice. "Forgive him. Forgive him." 4 days later, and moments before the Grossmayers had to make the decision to remove Anne from life support, Andy remembers feeling a connection between his daughter and Christ, between her blood and his. Forgiveness, the reporter writes, runs deep in the Grossmayers' creed. I realized it was not just Anne asking me to forgive Connor. It was Jesus Christ. "Connor owed us a debt he could never repay," said Anne's mother, Kate, before she was to visit Connor in prison to forgive him. "And releasing him from that debt would release us from expecting that anything in this world could satisfy us. Anything except the mercy whose name they knew and who surely had entered into the chaos of their daughter's murder." How do you forgive the unforgivable? How do merely human beings bear hurt and hatred and evil without vindictiveness? In the aftermath of this Advent, I know only enough to follow him who enters into our chaos still, into the little towns where hopes and fears of all the years meet, into the city streets where the voices of wailing and lamentation are heard, parents weeping for their children, refusing to be consoled because they are no more. There, I promise you, above your dark and dreamless sleep, you will hear him weeping too. For in him, the impossibility of love has come down at Christmas. And through his tears, he has forgiven you.